Hello and welcome to Science World. Today we'll hear about India's latest milestone in space technology. Speaking of space, we'll also say goodbye to the European Space Agency's Venus Express mission and learn what new and amazing discovery has been made by NASA's Curiosity Mars rover. And today on our one-on-one segment, we talk with Dr. Chad Orzel, a scientist, college professor, and author of a new book that he hopes will make us feel less intimidated about science and show us how we can all discover our own inner scientist. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA Science, Health, and Technology Magazine, Science World. India has successfully launched its largest rocket and unmanned capsule, which could send astronauts into space. India's geosynchronous satellite launch vehicle, MK-3, blasted off from the southern state of Andhra Pradesh early Thursday. India has successfully launched lighter satellites in recent years, but has faced problems sending up heavier payloads. Speaking of space exploration, this past week, one space mission came to an end while another has made a remarkable discovery. Science World's Bob Doty has more.
The European Space Agency announced this week that the space probe it sent to orbit Venus back in 2006 has reached the end of its life. Called the Venus Express, the spacecraft ran out of its propellant after executing a number of thruster burns that returned the probe to a normal orbit following a daring low-altitude exploratory operation this past June and July. During the last week of November, mission officials thought that the space probe still had some remaining propellant after completing the low-altitude operation. However, attempts to boost the spacecraft back up to its previous orbiting altitude failed. ESA lost full contact with the probe on November 28th. Mission officials did manage to partially re-establish the telemetry and telecommand links for a short time afterward, but could only retrieve a limited amount of information. Patrick Martin, ESA's Venus Express mission manager, said that the spacecraft probably ran out of its remaining fuel about halfway through the November efforts to raise its altitude. He noted the probe had already exceeded its life expectancy. Meanwhile, officials at NASA JPL say the Martian rover Curiosity has discovered signs of the building blocks of life on the red planet. According to NASA, those conclusions are based on a tenfold jump in the levels of the organic chemical methane the rover detected in the Martian atmosphere. Curiosity also found other organic molecules in samples of rock powder that had been collected by its robotic drill. NASA JPL officials announced these new findings during a news briefing held Tuesday at the American Geophysical Union's convention in San Francisco. The news was published online this week in the journal Science. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Media reports say U.S. authorities have linked last month's crippling cyber attack against Sony Pictures Entertainment to North Korea. The attack was made to pressure the studio into canceling the release of The Interview, a new film that parodies North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Brian Patton tells us that this incident is familiar to companies in South Korea, which have a history of being targeted by the North.
Simon Choi, a cybersecurity researcher at an antivirus company in Seoul called Hayuri Incorporated, studied the malware codes used to hack into the Sony Corporation's computer system. He says these codes are similar to the ones used in a cyber attack on South Korean media companies in 2012. He says they confirmed that the malware used in the past was from an IP address from North Korea, and the malware found in the Sony Pictures case is the same. So he thinks the Sony Pictures case is related to North Korea. Other security analysts have described the attack as state-sponsored, and several sources said that North Korea was the government involved. A U.S. government official cited in media reports said that Washington has come to the same conclusion but is hesitant to officially accuse North Korea of launching a cyber terrorism attack. The attack on Sony exposed tens of thousands of sensitive documents. The perpetrators have also threatened to release more unless Sony canceled the planned release of the movie The Interview, a dark comedy about the assassination of Kim Jong-un. The studio and distributors gave in to the demand after the hackers, who call themselves the Guardians of Peace, appeared to threaten physical attacks on the theaters that show the movie. The North Korean government denied involvement in the cyber attack on Sony, but called it a righteous deed and concedes that it may have been done by North Korea supporters. Earlier this year, Pyongyang called the movie itself an act of war. Sony is estimated to have lost more than $100 million in both costs incurred and anticipated revenue just from canceling the movie. But security analysts say cyber attacks can pose much bigger threats to national security, with the potential to shut down power utilities, aviation networks, and financial companies. Kim Hong-kwon, the president of a dissident group called North Korea Intellectual Solidarity, says Pyongyang has been developing their cyber capabilities for over a decade. He says from 2004 to 2009, they were in a stage where they advanced their capability by building their specific strategies and directly attacking South Korea. Since then, North Korea, he says, has entered a stage of improvement and development. It is hard and costly to prevent these attacks. Choi says South Korea has set up a kind of early warning cooperative network to alert companies of any attempts to penetrate cybersecurity. If hacking incidents occur, he says, or malware from North Korea is found, the government will share the information with the companies to respond immediately. The U.S. says it is working to bring the perpetrators of this attack to justice and is considering a range of options to respond. But this could prove difficult, given that North Korea is already, for the most part, cut off from the global economy and under United Nations sanctions for pursuing its nuclear program. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
A few minutes ago, we heard about India's latest success in space exploration technology. So for this week's Science World Quick Quiz, we want to know the name of what has been acknowledged as the very first satellite India sent into space. Was it A, Aryabhata, B, Kulpana, or C, Rohini? Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer a few minutes from now.
Listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
An experiment using computer and other visual manipulations allowed subjects to see themselves as someone from a different racial group in what can be called virtual body swapping. Jessica Berman tells us more.
Researchers made people think they had a different body to see if their unconscious biases towards someone of a different race, age, or sex also changed. In a paper published in the journal Trends in Cognitive Sciences, investigators describe how they use computerized virtual reality and, in other experiments, a prosthetic arm trick to make subjects think they inhabited the body of someone from a different racial or age group. The so-called rubber hand illusion involves the participant putting their hand behind a screen while a rubber hand of a different color is on the table in front of them. When the rubber hand is struck at exactly the same time their own unseen hand is, they feel as if the prosthesis is part of their body. According to Mano Sakiris, a psychology professor at Royal Holloway University of London, it's actually pretty easy to trick the brain into thinking it inhabits the body of another person.
So, for example, white participants to embody a black body, or an adult to suddenly become a child. So we use this kind of virtual reality techniques to create illusions of embodiment, so that you start feeling as if you have black skin or that your body size is smaller than it is.
Sakiris and an international team of researchers wanted to see whether virtually swapping bodies like that could alter someone's deeply ingrained feelings and stereotypes of different social groups. They wanted to know if people's feelings change in a perceptible way, if they felt ownership of the transformed individual they saw before them. Sakura says they used a psychology tool called an implicit association task to see whether the subjects attached fewer negative images and concepts to someone of a different group after the experiment.
What we found is that as a result of this change in embodiment of becoming someone else, people's implicit racial bias changes. They become less negatively biased against out-groups. And this is a very interesting finding because it goes beyond any kind of explicit views that people may have about different groups.
Sakiris says the finding was consistent over several studies that used different virtual body swapping techniques.
If you change people's self-representation, you change the way they stereotype and the way they relate to others.
Sakiris notes the controversy in the United States over policing involving racial stereotypes in predominantly African American communities. He says it may be possible from his work to develop exercises to help sensitize police officers to the citizens they interact with.
So you can have interventions that using the same kind of technique that allows people to take the perspective of someone else and see how the world is experienced from their perspective. And by doing so, you might change how people relate to others, how people behave towards others.
The researchers are doing high-tech imaging studies to see how the brain changes when someone identifies with another individual through virtual body swapping, as well as how long the effects last. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Governments failed to come to a breakthrough agreement at last week's climate summit in Peru. But a South African brewer sent delegates to the talks and says it is one of many private companies taking their own steps to fight climate change. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
At this year's climate change conference in Peru, the 194 nations present failed to meet a firm agreement to cut carbon emissions. They will meet again next year in Paris in hopes of hammering out a concrete agreement. But this year at the conference, more private industry giants said they have a large role to play in pushing for improvement, and major industry creates the bulk of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. The world's second largest beer brewer, SABMiller, which was founded in South Africa but is now based in Britain, sent delegates to this year's climate change conference as part of a strategy to partner with governments to better care for the environment. Vice President for Corporate Affairs for SABMiller Peru, Felipe Cantuarias, says any climate change discussions need to include input from major industry. He spoke to VOA News via Skype from Lima, Peru.
All these issues are not going to be resolved just by one government, by NGOs or multilateral agencies working alone. I think the main request by everybody at the meeting was this has to be addressed as a partnership working all together.
But he acknowledged that not all businesses have the same environmental interests. His company, which is also the largest Coca-Cola bottler in Africa, has a particular focus, and with annual revenues of more than $23 billion, a lot is at stake.
One of the main challenges we are facing right now is water, water scarcity. So that becomes part of our strategy. The same with food security. All along with our value chain, food security becomes a challenge for our business and also for our communities.
He cited projects in sub-Saharan Africa that aim at improving these issues, such as a project in Uganda to grow sorghum to make beer, reducing the need to import ingredients. He said while this year's climate agreement is far from perfect, progress is being made.
That was said in the COP20 in Peru, even though there have been some criticism about the lack of aggressive agreements, I will say that we have made progress. I think we have moved forward some important basic agreements that are critical to really start seeing some progress around issues like food security and water security.
But ultimately, he said, the fight against climate change does not rest on one government, one company, or one person, but on everyone. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. Our question was, we want to know the name of what has been acknowledged as the very first satellite India sent into space. Was it A, Aryabhata, B, Kupuna, or C, Rohini? The answer is A. While both answers B and C are also the names of a few Indian spacecraft, the name of the very first satellite India successfully launched into space was called Aryabhata. Named after the great 5th century Indian mathematician and astronomer Aryabhata, the 360-kilogram spacecraft was launched aboard the Soviet Union's Cosmos 3M rocket from the Volgograd Launch Station on April 19, 1975. The Aryabhata carried a payload of instruments to perform an ambitious program of experiments, including X-ray astronomy, aeronomics, and solar physics. But unfortunately, a power failure 4 days after launch halted further experimentation. NASA says that all signals from the spacecraft were lost after 5 days of operation. The satellite did manage to maintain its orbit for 17 years until it re-entered the Earth's atmosphere on February 11, 1992. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
What do you picture in your mind when you think of a scientist? Many would say an incredibly intelligent and educated man or woman, probably wearing glasses and wearing a white lab coat as they intensely study an equation or mix a new chemical formula atop a Bunsen burner. Those of us who are non-scientists can also, at times, feel intimidated or shy while talking about science-oriented subjects with scientists, afraid of looking stupid in front of these learned people. But Dr. Chad Orzel, who has a Ph.D. in chemical physics, held a postdoctoral fellowship at Yale University, and is now a professor at Union College in Schenectady, New York, says that scientific thinking really is a basic human activity and is something we do all the time. In his new book, Eureka! Discovering Your Inner Scientist, Dr. Orzel says that many of the things we do for fun, such as playing sports, cooking, doing a crossword puzzle, or even trying to solve a TV or movie mystery, all use the same scientific processes that have led to some of the world's most significant discoveries. Dr. Orzel joins us for today's one-on-one segment to talk about why science really isn't as difficult or as mystifying as many of us make it out to be, and how all of us can discover our own inner scientist. Dr. Orzel, why did you write this book?
This book comes about because of a conversation killer. When I tell people that I'm a scientist, one of the most frequent responses is some variant of, oh, you must be really smart. Which there's really nowhere to go with that, and it's sort of off-putting. It's a statement that people who do science are sort of different than ordinary people, that they're smart in a kind of qualitatively different fashion. You know, it's flattering to my vanity, but it's really not true, that the processes that scientists use to do science are really not that different than what anybody else does in their everyday life.
A lot of people think that science really is intimidating, and that's perhaps why people say you've got to be smart to be a scientist. So what do you tell people to reassure them that science is basically for everyone?
The idea is absolutely anything that you do has some skill and some training involved in it. The example that I use in the book is carpentry, right? If I have to, I can build something simple out of wood, but I'm not very good at it. But somebody who spends a lot of time working with wood will look at a problem and immediately see a simple and elegant way to get the effect that they want, something that I would only arrive at very laboriously and not very successfully. So there's a mental aspect to things like carpentry that I really can't do because I just don't do that very often. But nobody goes around telling someone who's a very good carpenter, well, you must be really smart. So a lot of it comes down to it's mostly inclination and practice that, you know, I'm successful in science because I happen to enjoy doing the sort of things that make somebody a successful scientist, whereas someone who goes into woodworking happens to enjoy that considerably more than I do.
Regarding attitudes concerning science and scientists, and although this doesn't seem to be as prevalent today as perhaps in years past, some people, especially boys and young men, kind of look down on science because they don't want to be labeled as a nerd and be an outcast.
And that's a very real problem. And that's another thing that's very strange about science relative to other activities, right? That if you establish that you're not going to do it for a career, people sort of expect you to give up on it entirely in a way that they don't for other things. I regularly play basketball a couple of days a week with a bunch of other middle-aged professors and staff here at Union, and nobody thinks that's weird that, you know, I go and play sports, even though I'm not nearly good enough to make a career out of it. But people think it's a little strange if you try to pursue science on sort of an amateur basis.
You write about the four steps that go into the process of science. Can you tell us about it?
The core of science is a process that is incredibly simple, and it's part of everything that we do. You look at the world around you and identify something that needs to be explained. You think about why the world might work the way that it does. You test your theory for how it might work by further observations and some experiments. And once you figure out what's going on, you tell everyone you know the results of that. And that look, think, test, tell process is part of any number of simple everyday activities that people do for fun and relaxation.
Is there a link between common hobbies like stamp coin, rock collecting, or even cooking?
Absolutely. If you look at maybe one of the most iconic scientists in history is Charles Darwin with the theory of evolution. If you look at why Darwin was successful with his theory and why he's remembered as the father of evolution, it comes down to the fact that he had collected an enormous amount of information about the natural world. And having all of that information enabled him to look at patterns that were there and come up with a very solid scientific theory that would pass muster with the scientific community, which other writers who predated Darwin had the basic idea that maybe living things evolve and change over time, but they didn't have the mountain of data that he brought to the table that enabled him to become the iconic scientist that he is.
People have learned to depend more on personal technology like computers and the internet, and of course mobile technology such as smartphones and tablets are very popular. How has this connected ordinary people to science?
Well, for one thing, most of the silly little games that you would play on a smartphone actually use the process of science in a very central way, right? If you look at something like Angry Birds, in order to succeed at that, you have to go through the steps of the scientific process. So that is an example of a very simple activity that a ridiculous number of people do every day that's essentially scientific.
So how could people of science make their field more approachable and less intimidating?
One of the things that I hope to do with the book is to help people who are not scientists to realize that, you know, this process that's at the core is something that's very familiar and that you can recognize and you can see the traces of that in science. And so that helps to make the general public a little less afraid of looking at science. The other thing that scientists can do is just to recognize that there are these connections between the scientific method and everyday activities and make use of that. You can make analogies between the process that you're using to measure something and the process by which you would carry out certain hobbies.
Could you explain in a nutshell, perhaps, what we non-scientists discover our inner scientist?
The idea is just to recognize that this process is part of all sorts of things that you do. So if you're doing a crossword puzzle or playing a card game like bridge or playing sports like basketball or football, you're making use of the same process, this looking at the world, thinking about what's going on, testing your theories, and sharing them with other people. And that's a process that's part of all sorts of activities. And if you can be a little more consciously aware of that process, then you can use that in a more direct way to help improve your life. This process of science is something that goes as far back as we have evidence of humans. We have traces of people doing science. And that's what's ultimately made us the dominant species on the planet. That's something that, you know, we've used for millennia, and often in a sort of unconscious way. But I think taking a little more conscious control of that, making use of it, is an incredibly powerful tool for making things better.
That was Dr. Chad Orzel, a professor at Union College in Schenectady, New York, and author of the new book, Eureka, Discovering Your Inner Scientist. The book is published by Basic Books and can be found at your favorite local or online bookstore. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.